Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Mark Rank about his latest book, The Random Factor, How Chance and Luck Profoundly Shape Our Lives and the World Around Us. But we will also talk, certainly, about his earlier work on poverty in such books as Poorly Understood, What America Gets Wrong About Poverty, and The Poverty Paradox, Understanding Economic Hardship Amid American Prosperity. And you can learn more about Mark's work at, and this is a long website, I'm sorry, but it's what's available, Brown School, all one word, .WUSTL. Washington University, St. Louis, WUSTL.edu/faculty-and-research/Mark-Rank. I tried to find a shorter one. There isn't, but his stuff is worth looking at, and you can find a good deal of articles over the years, etc. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at economics, politics, environment, health, science, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, TerrenceMcNally.net. Today's guest has made reckoning with poverty and inequality his life's work. It's about people and families, not theory. Beyond defining poverty, its causes, or even its effects on people's lives, Rank has moved to deeper questions, not so much about the individuals falling into or trapped in poverty, but more about the society in which it takes place. Why does our society produce more poverty than other wealthy countries? And why don't we, or why can't we, change our incentives? I expect we'll talk about the thinking around poverty in the U.S., explore some myths, nail some facts. You can tell from his book titles, such as Poorly Understood and The Poverty Paradox, that he's wrestling with this stuff. At one point, he asked himself, do you want to focus on who loses out at the economic game in the U.S., or do you want to focus on why the economic game produces losers in the first place? He talks about structural vulnerability, the perspective that sees poverty as ultimately the result of failures at the structural level of our economy, our society, our culture, and our politics, which ensure that poverty will exist and will persist. His latest book seems at first a departure, dealing as it does with the notion of luck, something which lies outside the control of society as well as that of individuals. And Mark explains, when I was working on an earlier book about the American dream, I interviewed dozens of people from many walks of life. And during the course of those interviews, something very interesting came to light. As I listened to the twists and turns in people's lives, the role of luck and chance in shaping those twists and turns became quite apparent. This caught him by surprise and led him down the road of researching and delving into the topic, culminating with The Random Factor. I've been aware of Mark Rank's work for years, and shame on me that I hadn't invited him on the show earlier, but the quirky nature of the new book's approach spurred me to action. Luck and chance are not things we talk about or take as seriously as they deserve. To reckon with them in our understanding of ourselves, our lives, our relationships, and naturally, given that the word can be synonymous with luck, our fortunes, strikes me as a rebellion against the rational, mechanical worldview of much of the Enlightenment. How's that for a setup? P.S., it's pretty clear to me that giving chance its due when it comes to poverty in no way lets Jack Welch, McKinsey, racism or sexism, or politics off the hook. Mark Robert Rank, the Herbert S. Hadley Professor of Social Welfare at Washington University in St. Louis, has devoted much of his career, as I said, to issues of poverty, inequality, and social justice. He's developed a website, Confronting Poverty, one word, confrontingpoverty.org, that explores the life course risk of poverty and its consequences. The life course risk of poverty for all of us. Rank has authored 10 books, including Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes, One Nation Underprivileged, Why American Poverty Affects Us All, The Poverty Paradox, Poorly Understood, and his latest, The Random Factor, How Chance and Luck Profoundly Shape Our Lives and the World Around Us. Welcome, Mark Frank, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Well, thanks, Terrence. Thanks so much for that introduction. I feel like my whole life kind of passed in front of me. So it's great to be with you.
Thank you. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, March 26th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. So you talked about your life passing before you. Well, can you tell us in your words a bit about how you see your path to the life you've led, the work you do, and feel free, we've got an hour here, feel free to go way back, childhood inspirations, mentors, turning points, that sort of thing.
Well, you know, when you think back on your life, it's definitely related to this latest book, which is, you know, there are different twists and turns, and you could go certain ways or go other ways, and certain kind of random and chance things had an effect, you know, on how your life has played out. So certainly in my case, you know, I've always been interested in kind of issues of social justice and what's right and what's wrong and things like that. And it struck me, you know, in my sort of when I went on to university, that economic inequality is really a big issue here in the United States. And so I became interested in that and did my graduate work on issues of inequality and particularly poverty. And that's kind of followed my my career throughout. So as you pointed out in the introduction, I've done a number of books and articles dealing with, particularly with American poverty and thinking about it, and thinking about this question, this paradox question of why is it that, you know, in this country that, you know, we are the wealthiest country in the world, we also have some of the highest rates, if not the highest rates, of poverty amongst the sort of industrialized Western countries, and thinking about, you know, why that is the case. So, I've kind of, you know, that's kind of been my trajectory. And then, as you also pointed out in the introduction, in an earlier book, where I was looking at the American Dream, lots of people that I interviewed talked about, you know, how their lives unfolded and things like that. But one of the things they brought up, which I had not anticipated, was this idea of chance and luck and randomness in terms of how their specific lives unfolded. And I started thinking about, you know, that's really interesting, and that's really a very unstudied area, particularly in the social sciences. You know, philosophers have talked about that for a long time, and other folks as well. But in the social sciences, it's really very little has been written about that. And so I started, you know, delving into it, and that's kind of the topic of the latest book. So there we are.
Okay, and one thing I'm gonna let you know is that we're gonna deal with poverty for a while at first, because you have so much to say about it, and I want to establish kind of that, and then we will get to the random factor. But so with regard to poverty, you've been at this a long time. Let me ask you two related questions. What has changed about poverty in America in your time of, you know, I'm mm-hmm. guessing you've been at this yeah. 45 years or something yeah. like that. Well, something and like what that. Has surprised you over the years? Perhaps it's in how persistent poverty has been and remains and that sort of thing. But what's changed and what's surprised you?
I guess, you know, it's kind of both of those issues are interconnected in the sense that in some ways, very little has changed.
Yeah.
So let's go back to 1959. And that was the year when we first started measuring poverty, the U.S. Census Bureau. From 1959 to 1973, the poverty rate in the United States was cut in half. It was like 22% in 1959, 11% in 1973. You know, Ronald Reagan was famous for saying we fought a war on poverty and poverty won, but actually the war on poverty had a big effect on reducing the rate of poverty in the United States during the 1960s, along with the strong economy. But since the early 1970s, the poverty rate in the United States has remained roughly between 11 and 15% over these decades. And so in that sense, not much has changed over this period of time. And so that's interesting. Particular groups, there have been some changes. So going back to 1959, the group, the age group in the United States that had the highest rates of poverty was the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
Their poverty rates was about 35%. So over a third of all folks over the age of 65 were considered in poverty. Today, their rates of poverty are around 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a dramatic reduction in the rate of poverty. And the main reason is Social Security and Medicare.
Sure.
Those have had a tremendous effect on reducing poverty. And this gets to my point that you alluded to also in the introduction, that's very much of a structural reason. It doesn't have to do with individuals working hard or not working hard. It has to do with government programs that are having a big effect on reducing the rate of poverty. So that's one change that you know, a success story that's happened mm-hmm. over this period of time. But the other side of that is that for children,
yeah.
their rates of poverty have remained very, very high. And so of all the age groups in the United States, the group with the highest risk of poverty is young children. And so, you know, that's the other side of the coin where we've had very little success in reducing their rates of poverty.
Yeah, and I think people should really take that in. You know, a couple of things pop into my head as you're saying that. One is that seniors vote, in fact, vote mm-hmm. disproportionately high, and children do not.
Yeah.
Another implication, though, is that, you know, whether, wait, I don't want to say this in as callous a way as it sounds, especially considering I am among the seniors, but it's like they're in the last innings. The score may be settled, and now it's a question of health and fulfillment and friendships and relationships and that sort of thing. But children are the future. Children and immigration are the future, and those are two issues or two groups that we are failing desperately.
Yeah, no, Terrence, you're exactly right. I mean, if you want to think about you know, having the biggest bang for your buck, you should put it into children. You should put it into children doing well economically and socially, because that's where the real, you know, payback is going to be. So I did a study a couple years ago that looked at trying to estimate what is the economic cost of childhood poverty in the United States. How much does this actually cost us as a society? And there were lots of things we had to focus just on a few things that we had data for. So we know that children in poverty are more likely to have health problems. They're more likely to have problems in terms of a criminal justice system, and they're more likely to be not as productive workers when they become adults. So we factored those in, and what we found was that on an annual basis, childhood poverty was costing the United States slightly over $1 trillion a year. Now, in 2015, what this data was pegged mm-hmm. to, that was 28% of the entire federal budget. So the reason I'm bringing this up is just to just to reinforce the point that you're making, which is that investing in children and investing in their economic well-being is one of the smartest economic policies we can do. Investing in the economic well-being of the elderly is important, but it's not nearly the sort of, you don't get the bang for the buck that you do with children. And so I make the argument, you know, that look, There's all kinds of reasons why we should be addressing poverty, particularly children's poverty in the United States. There's social justice reasons and there's moral reasons and all of that. But there's also a really strong economic argument that by doing that, we all economically benefit as a result.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a strong, strong message. And as a, going back to the first thing I said, seniors vote, children don't. And in fact, young working families don't vote at the rate of seniors, people for whom this impacts them. You know, they are the laggards when it comes to political decision making. I read a review by Timothy Noah. That linked your book, The Poverty Paradox, which came out in
23, yep,
with Matthew Desmond's Poverty by America. And it seems your books and your perspectives overlap a great deal. I think Desmond has made a mark and people are familiar with his work. How do you see his work and yours in terms of similarities and differences or ways in which you sort of buttress each other and that sort of thing?
Yeah. No, that it was an interesting review. And as you said, point out with Matthew's book and my book, we're coming kind of from a similar type of perspective. What he does in his book, and I also teach a course every year on poverty in America, and we talk about different theories of poverty and different explanations. And the kind of perspective that he's taking is one that goes back a long ways, which says that, you know, why does poverty exist? And one argument is, well, because it's functional for certain groups in society. There's a reason why poverty exists. It's not just random to use something that I'm familiar with. It's not just random. There's a benefit. So, for example, by having people that are working at low wages, we all benefit because we can go to McDonald's and get a hamburger for a low price because of that. You know, that kind of thing. So that's the argument the strong argument that he makes, and I'm certainly sympathetic to that. I think my work is somewhat different in that I also use a lot of data and sort of firsthand data and the kind of life course perspective, which a lot of my work focuses on, which says, okay, let's not just think about how many folks are poor in a given year, but let's think about what's your long-term risk of poverty across adulthood. Now, that's a unique perspective, and as as we can talk about, the reality is that actually the majority of Americans at some point during their adulthood will experience at least 1 year below the official poverty line. So the argument I make is, you know, we often frame the issue of poverty as one of them versus us.
Mm-hmm. But the way I put it, Mark, was poverty happens to poor people.
Yeah, right. Or it happens to folks of a different color or whatever. You know, it's like this other group. But actually, 2/3 of Americans will experience poverty. So it's like the majority of us will. And if you think of it that way, then you think, well, wait a minute. That puts a different lens on this. And that sort of says, you know, maybe I ought to pay attention to this. This might happen to me. And that's where, you know, you mentioned my Confronting Poverty website. On that website is a poverty calculator, and people can go there and they can put in their demographic information and they can see what their actual risk of poverty in the next 5, 10, or 15 years is. And a lot of folks are going to be quite surprised by that risk is actually pretty large.
Yes, and my guess is that the longer you live, the more likely it is. This, of course, made me reflect on my own life. And there was a period, despite, having attended Harvard and there was a period when I was kind of beginning career and switching careers and stuff that I got food stamps. Yeah, you know what I mean? I was an actor for a while. Unemployment is essential.
Oh. Yeah, it's endemic.
Yeah. Exactly. So I certainly found myself in there. I was I qualified.
Just to sort of kind of give a little more detail on that. You know, what, so people will often say to me, well, how, you know, how can you, how could that be? How could, you know, how can you say that a majority or 2/3 of Americans will experience poverty? But think of it this way. We're talking about over a 30 or 40 year period. And over that course of time, things happen to people.
Yes.
And this is where chance and luck comes into play. Sometimes those are, that's, there's some bad things that can happen. So you could get sick, or you could get on, you could be unemployed, or a family could split up. And the more time you look at risk, the more likely that risk may happen. And so that's the reason, because most poverty researchers focus on a short term. So like, what's the poverty rate this past year?
Mm-hmm.
Very few people look at a 20 or 30 year framework. And again, by doing that, it casts a different spell on sort of thinking about all of this.
Yeah, very much so. And both you and Desmond, and the approaches you've talked about, are kind of a new way of thinking, that for many decades, the prevailing framework for examining poverty was set by, according to Noah and others, by Oscar Lewis in his 59 study of the five Mexican families. And what he talked about was the culture of poverty.
Right.
And people focused on what was the behaviors, what was single parenthood, welfare dependence. Bill Clinton, you know, when he put the 5-year limit on cash payments to low-income families, that's on a culture of poverty paradigm.
Right.
You and you, let's just talk about, you break away from that with your notion of structural vulnerability.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah. So, you know, so kind of going back to this thinking about the long-term risk of poverty. So most people who experience poverty do so for a fairly short period of time. It may be a year or two, and then they get their feet back on the ground, and they're okay, and then maybe something happens down the road. In those cases, there's very little of this culture of poverty. You know, I've interviewed hundreds of people over the course of my career, and lots of these people, lots of the people I've interviewed are in have been in tough sort of economic conditions, and what they want in their lives and what they want for their kids and their work motivation is similar to anybody else. There's very little difference. Now, it is the case, and this is what Oscar Lewis is really talking about more, that for folks who are in poverty for long periods of time and who are really in economically depressed areas like Appalachia or inner cities, you know, who have experienced poverty for really long periods of time, they may try to adapt to those situations in certain ways that actually make a lot of sense but might be counterproductive in terms of getting out of poverty. And that's where the culture of you might find the culture of poverty. But what people have made the mistake of doing is saying, well, that applies to everybody in poverty.
Right.
Well, that's not the case at all. And so it's important to think about, you know, that there are different different kinds of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And most poverty tends to be fairly short term, as I said. But for about maybe 10 to 15% of folks that experience poverty, it's long term. And there you might find some of this culture of poverty going on. But for the rest of the folks, I make the argument that much of that poverty is the result of a structural failure, of not enough jobs, not enough policies in place to protect people when things happen to them. And so, you know, that's a very different way of thinking about it. And I love the way you led into the introduction by saying, which is my key point, one of my key points, is that do we want to focus on the losers of the game, or do we want to focus on why the game produces losers in the first place? Those are both valid questions. But what we've done in this country is we've almost always focused on the losers of the game and not why the structure of the game creates losers.
Yeah, excellent, excellent point. One of the things that keeps rattling around in my brain as we're having this section of the conversation is that thing that people talk about, how many millions of Americans cannot afford a $400 emergency.
Right.
Whether that be a car accident, a car repair, something in your house, you know, a roof, a problem with your roof, if you're lucky enough to own your own home. And more often than not, a medical emergency. I forget the number right now, but it's a staggeringly high number and seems to go very much hand in hand with your notion that it will happen to most of us at some point.
Yeah, exactly. And the number is varies from year to year, but it's about 35 to 40% of Americans do not have $400 right now on hand if an emergency happened. I mean, that's unbelievable when you think about it. And this is the saying of living paycheck to paycheck.
Yes.
That's exactly what we're talking about here. Is there's little, very little leeway there. People are living paycheck to paycheck. They don't have $400, and so when something happens, you know, like your hours are cut back, or you know, or your car breaks down, you don't have the money to cover it, and that can throw you into poverty because there's not a lot to protect folks.
Right.
So I think that's a really powerful example that you're giving here.
And I think a corollary of that perhaps is the finding over the last several years that fear of that emergency, fear of what would happen, actually impacts our health and our cognitive ability.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of research, you know, in the last few years that have focused on, you know, the effects that poverty has both on physical health and mental health. So, you know, you can just imagine. I mean, we all have problems, right? We all have worries and concerns like that. But when you're struggling just to meet the bills and to have enough food on the table, it only amplifies those worries. And so, you know, there's a lot of stress involved. And again, this is one of the things when you talk to people who are in poverty, it comes out right away is that what folks are doing is just, you know, living on a day-to-day basis, just trying to survive this period of time where they're really struggling. And there's just a tremendous amount of stress, particularly if you have kids in the household, that only amplifies it. So that's very much the case.
Okay, and I'm going to make a point about the structural conditions ripe for poverty, but I don't think we have time to talk about it, which is that a great deal of it has to do with the job market. I will allow you to talk about your musical chairs analogy because that fits exactly with the question we were just talking about, which is not who's in poverty, but why does our society engender it. But why I mentioned Jack Welch, the famous cutthroat CEO of GE, and McKinsey, is that I see two of them as strong emblematic figures who put efficiency and in return to shareholder above all. And that, I think, that approach to business and commerce in this country is one of the great contributors to why we have so much poverty. But your musical chairs.
Yes. And just a little point on what you were just saying is that I think, you know, there used to be much more of a social compact between employer and employee.
Yep.
And the idea being that we're in this together.
Yes.
You know, this kind of, and that has really, since the 80s, that has really fallen by the wayside. And so it's just cutthroat. And it's like, yeah. So absolutely. So musical chairs. So this is one of my favorite analogies. And I like to use analogies because it can bring sort of theoretical concepts to life. And so what I say is, you know, let's picture a game of musical chairs. We have 10 people playing and 8 chairs. Who's going to win and lose? So if we just focus on the winners and losers, those two people who lost out weren't as fast. They were in a bad position when the music stopped. All those kinds of things. And that explains why those two folks lost out. But if we step back and we say, well, wait a minute, there's only 8 chairs for 10 players, then it doesn't really, those characteristics only explain who the losers are, not why there are losers in the first place. And what you were saying before about really what we're talking about in terms of jobs and the economy, we have so many low-paying jobs. We have, unemployment varies over time, but there always are not enough jobs for everybody who wants them. And so somebody's going to lose out at that game. Now, who's going to lose out? Well, it's people with less education. education, less skills, and so on. And you can say that's why those people lost out. But if you step back and say, wait a minute, there aren't enough jobs in the first place, then that's looking at the structure of the game. And if you really want to address the issue, want to address poverty, then you have to focus on getting enough chairs for everybody who's playing the game. And that would mean getting enough decent paying jobs for everybody who's in the labor market.
That's right. And I would emphasize what you just said in those two words, decent paying. In other
Absolutely.
Words, what we have seen since the 80s is not just cutthroat efficiency, but the notion that that people can work 40, 60, 70 hours a week and hardly make enough to still be in that category we talked about where they don't have enough money to afford an emergency. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking today with Mark Robert Rank about his latest book, The Random Factor, How Chance and Luck Profoundly Shape Our Lives and the World Around Us. And we are still at this point in the conversation talking about his larger work over the years on poverty in books such as Poorly Understood and The Poverty Paradox. You can learn more at, and this is going to be a long website, if you want it, get your pen ready or your keyboard, Brownschool, one word, .WUSTL, Washington University, St. Louis is what that stands for, WUSTL.EDU. And then faculty and research, and then Mark Rank. His other website, confrontingpoverty.org, you can get to very easily and learn a lot there. What I'd love you to do, and we will get back to chance and luck and the random factor, but I think you do such a great job, and it is so so essential to the books I'm talking about, like Poorly Understood and Poverty Paradox, are myths and facts. Mm. And I'm sure you've gotten to where you can do this quickly. A few of the myths and facts about poverty and about the safety net.
Yeah, you're right. There's so many of them, but you know, let's just take a couple. So one is what we were talking about earlier,
right,
which is, you know, one of the myths is poverty happens to somebody else. It's not going to happen to me. It's some other group. That's clearly wrong. You know, as I talked about
right,
my life course research,
we've kind of dealt with that one. Yep.
Right. Exactly. Another one kind of related to that is, well, poverty is really a black issue or a brown issue.
Or an inner city issue. Yeah.
Or an inner city issue.
Right.
Well, it turns out that actually the highest rates of poverty are found in rural America.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people don't – that's like, really? Well, think about it. Appalachia, the Mississippi Delta, Indian reservations have the highest rates of poverty of any area. So that goes counter to that. In terms of the safety net – you know, one myth is, well, you know, we've got a safety net that's in place and that, you know, kind of protects people. Well, our social safety net is the weakest of really any of the industrialized countries.
By far.
You know, there's very little protection. And that's a major reason why our poverty rates are so high, because we do so little to protect people from falling into poverty. Other countries, like the European countries and others, you know, have pretty strong protections in place so that when you lose a job, there's something to protect you. Here, there's hardly anything. So that's another, you know, that's another.
I'm gonna point to two more that I want you to. One is, because I think it is so right on the money, if you will, is the myth of the American dream, for which you wrote an entire book. But that notion is anyone in America can make it with enough hard work and talent.
Yes.
The political right beats this one, you know, to death. What's going on there?
Well, you beat me to the punch, because that was what I was just going to say as my next one. So this idea that, you know, that first of all, our country, you know, since the get-go has been steeped in the idea of rugged individualism, that, you know, you do it on your own, you know, and there's plenty of opportunities and this kind of thing. Okay, look, as I said before, I've talked to many, 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 many people, and some of the hardest working people are folks in or near poverty. They are struggling. struggling and they are working really hard. It's not a question of working hard. Again, it's a question of these structural kinds of failings. So the idea that, you know, you can just do it on your own is really a myth. And another myth connected to the American dream is the myth of rising from rags to riches. Now, there certainly are cases of people that rise from rags to riches, but there's a lot of empirical data over the last 20 years that has shown that actually economic mobility in the United States today is much less than in a number of other industrialized countries. We have less of people from the bottom to the top.
That's right. We prided ourselves on that, that people would poo-poo the safety net of the European countries and say, yeah, but the cost of that is people are stuck and you don't have the mobility you have here. That has turned around.
Exactly right. That has definitely turned around. And so that's another myth. And then,
I'm going to ask you one other one that I think is a safety net myth that I went, oh, yeah, is that safety net programs are the answer to poverty.
Mm. Right. So, again, from my perspective, what safety net programs are doing is, you know, it's kind of putting a Band-Aid on the wound. Poverty has already happened, and you're protecting people. But what you really want to do is have them avoid falling into poverty in the first place. And so that's where, you know, the answers are things like, you know, having enough jobs that pay a decent wage and things like that, or having programs in place that protect people from falling into poverty.
Okay, a question that I've seen you asked in a couple of other interviews, and so I'm just crediting that I actually saw the people ask, but it is, how are the non-poor, or the temporarily or currently non-poor, complicit in the poverty of others? What role do we play in perpetuating, and clearly we're perpetuating is the right word here, poverty in America?
Yeah, well, this gets back to this idea of thinking about poverty and who benefits from poverty. So, you know, when you've got folks that have to take any kind of job, you know, we wind up benefiting because we have lower prices in terms of certain goods and services and things like that. By sort of thinking about the issue as, well, it's not a high priority, we all kind of become a part of the problem because we're not really addressing it or not putting an emphasis on it. So, what we really need to do is think of this as a large community kind of issue, and that, you know, we all benefit by not having people falling, particularly children, into poverty. We all will benefit from that. We will become a better society, certainly a more ethical society, but also a more robust economy when we invest in our people. And that's what I always say is, like, you know, investing in children, investing in our human potential is one of the smartest things we can do. And so, you know, we need to shift the framework to think along those lines.
Yeah. And we haven't talked politics much, but a great deal of the polarization and the grievance that the right can use to win elections, which may or may not do anything to aid those poor people, is to prey on the fact that too many people are poor, that the social safety net is not robust enough, and all of that, and people feel left behind.
That's right. That's right. And certainly, you know, I would make the argument, and other people made the argument, that, you know, what Donald Trump really tied into was the fact that really for the last 50 years, if you look at male median wages today compared to 1973, they're like $100 more than they were in real terms than in 1973. What that's saying is that there has been complete stagnation in people trying to get ahead. They've been falling behind. And that's what the conservatives and Trump and all these folks have really tapped into. And they're correct. A lot of people have not been getting ahead. Now, the reason, what they say, I think is completely wrong, but they have tapped into that.
That's right. That's right. Well, as you point out, Since 2000, the share of national, this is since 2000, the share of national income going to labor has fallen by more than 10%.
Yeah.
And labor's loss is stock market's gain. That this shift to greater and greater inequality and the few at the top sucking up. I saw something recently that said billionaires in America have their wealth has increased 80% since the pandemic.
Wow.
I mean, it's a crazy statistic.
Wow. Yeah.
But it's a little bit from everybody else. And that creates the grievance, and that creates the potential for manipulation. Okay, let's switch to the random factor.
Okay.
Okay. And you already talked a little bit about the seed of this book, which was you talked to people and you found out the role that chance and twists and turns played in poverty and wealth and so on. And as you were saying that at the start of the show, Mark, I was thinking, you know, I asked that question about people's path of all my guests. And I would say the number that of people of, you know, success, whether they are successful, you know, as economists or successful as inventors, or the number of people that attribute it to chance encounter, those chance twists and turns, is almost complete. There's very few people that say, I set out to do this and it happened just like I planned.
Right.
Spielberg, maybe, right?
Yeah.
He started making movies when he was 10 or whatever, and, you know, the rest is history. But for most people, this is the case. So why was there a moment, besides you said from those interviews, a moment, an itch you had to scratch that you went, I got to write that one? Because I can imagine, being that it is a departure, it was one you probably put off.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I have been thinking about this for a long time, really since, you know, those interviews, which was like 2010, 2011, you know, and I started thinking about this, and then started looking around, and as I said before, there really hasn't been hardly anything written on it, and then I started thinking about it also in a larger context, which kind of the front part of the book talks about how history has been shaped by chance, how, you know, the natural world has been shaped by chance, and there's so many different interesting angles to this, and I thought, you know, and this was really, this was this book, a lot of times books are like, oh man, you know, this is like, I'm, you know, it's like work and it's like a marathon and I'm trying to get this thing done. And this book was like, man, this just like wrote itself. It was like a pleasure, you know, to do this.
Well, let me see if I have a sense of why, Mark.
Yeah.
And that is, I describe what I do in these conversations is learning while teaching. In other words, the listener's learning something, but they're learning because I'm learning. And if I'm not really interested, this conversation probably. And in this case, you were learning as you wrote.
Yeah, that is exactly right. That hits it right on the head. I was learning as I wrote, and it was like, wow, this is really interesting. And, you know, it's like, this is cool. You know, I hadn't thought of this.
Right.
Whereas if you've done it, you know, 100 times, it's like, well, you know.
It's
like,
a new, there's some new data. There's some new circumstances. But this was a whole other thing. So, just so people get a – and by the way, I think that I don't know what's going to happen, but it seems to me this book is really a larger, has a much larger public audience than your previous work. Not that there can't be a breakthrough book on poverty, but a book on chance and luck seems to me, you know, I hope that that the audience finds it and that it finds its audience.
Yeah, and that's what that's absolutely. I mean, this is a topic that everyone can relate to. It's fascinating. You know, and everybody you talk to, it's like they've had some element of this in their lives. They can relate to this. So I'm hoping for, as you said, a much wider audience. Not that, you know, poverty and inequality are certainly, but there's only so many folks that are interested in that, where this is very wide open.
Yeah, exactly. So I really wish you, as I will say, good luck.
That's appropriate.
With this one. Okay, I want you to, because I think there's fun stuff in here, just a little bit of chance in history, chance in nature.
Okay, so chance in history, I just wrote this piece about, you know, Oppenheimer, the movie, mm-hmm. you know, just swept all the awards and everything. And one of the things Oppenheimer was concerned about was, you know, in his later years, nuclear annihilation. And I talk about one story where only because of chance and luck this didn't happen. It was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. There's a long story here, but I'll make it short. And what happened was the Russians had sent four submarines, and unbeknownst to the Americans, one of those torpedoes on those submarines had a nuclear was nuclear tipped, and so it had the sort of impact of the bomb at Hiroshima. Well, one of the commanders almost fired that missile, and the only reason he didn't, he surfaced and he thought he was under attack, and a signaling officer got his foot stuck on the conning tower ladder. That brief few seconds allowed the second in command to realize we're not under attack, they're signaling, they want us to just stay surfaced. And that brief moment in time and that signaling officer getting his foot stuck saved World War III from happening. It was pure chance. That is pure random chance. And with a profound implication.
Oh my God, yes. Eric Schlosser, by the way, has a whole book.
Yeah.
Oh, you know this.
Yeah,
about
I do.
Near accidents. And in every one of them, there's some like little chance thing, which is
exactly
why.
And so here's the natural world one.
Yes.
The only reason we're here is 66 million years ago, an asteroid 20 miles wide hit the Earth and hit it in exactly the right place that caused the extermination of the dinosaurs and 75% of life on Earth. It led to the rise of the mammals, and including us. If that had entered the Earth's atmosphere 20 seconds later or earlier, you and I and the rest of us would not be here. Now that, and that's pure randomness, pure randomness.
Wait, why if that little difference in time would it have?
Because first of all, if it had been a minute or so, it would have missed the Earth.
Oh, okay.
And the Earth would have continued. Or the way that it hit in the Yucatan, and there was enough stuff in the soil that caused the kind of global winter that happened. And so it struck it, you know, right at the right spot. But again, the fact that happened, it's like random, you know, because that asteroid, as it was going around, is being affected by different gravitational forces and things like that. And so, you know, like, that's pretty profound.
Yes.
It's like the dinosaurs would still be here had that asteroid hadn't hit.
Right. And one thing that I, for the folks who are also kind of trying to picture this in their mind, what he just said is crucial, which is that it isn't that an asteroid is on a direct route.
Yeah.
It is pulled by the gravitational pull of every heavenly body it passes. And it, this is not, you know, it's not from the moment it begins its trajectory, you can say where it's going to land.
Right. No, it's like a pinball machine and the thing going around that, it's getting hit by different things.
Yes.
And then, yeah, yeah.
And as you point out, chance and luck had much more of a role in ancient societies, or there was more respect, let's say, in ancient societies, indigenous societies, and so on. And then went out of favor as rationality took hold. That's why I said I think that very much even exploring this and saying, wait a minute, this is playing a big role here, is a rebellion against the Enlightenment. But that Charles Darwin in natural selection is one of the ones that sort of brings it back and brings it back in science.
That's right. And yeah, and that's exactly correct. So, you know, in developing his theory of evolution, you know, one of the foundation elements of that is randomness in terms of mutations. So what happens is, as offspring are created, they're slightly different than their parents. And once in a while, there is a mutation. Sometimes it's bad, and occasionally it's good. And if it's good, it can allow that sort of trait to be passed along, which allows the species to better adapt to the environment. But that is, the mutation itself is random. It's completely random. It's completely chance. And so here we have a case where random interacts with sort of the idea of the survival of the fittest. And that's one of the points I make in the book, is that the world is not just, it's not just random and chance. There's an interaction that occurs between randomness and chance and larger structural forces that we've been talking about. So it's an interesting combination. I use the example of the analogy of currents and ripples.
Yes, I like that.
Yeah, so you can think, you know, I'm a sociologist, so, you know, we focus on things like the importance of social class and gender and race in terms of people's life outcomes. And those are all important. But what I say is that within those strong currents, there's lots of ripples of randomness that are happening. So when you think about, like, say, where you are right now, your particular job and where you wound up, there might be forces that were pushing you in a certain direction, but this specific job that you're in right now, there probably was a lot of chance and randomness in you winding up where you are. So that's how we can think about these things kind of coming together.
Yes, that it is not either or.
Exactly.
It is yes and. Yes, there are forces. Yep. Racism matters. You know, politics matter. If a certain ethic in the business community matters. But then chance is how that plays out in your life. This year, this day, I think it's fascinating because you had to think about this, which is why social science, sociologists, and other social scientists shy away from studying luck and chance.
Yes, and so one of the reasons I say, particularly in sociology, is, you know, we like to look at kind of social structural forces and how they play out. Well, you know, chance and luck go against that. It's
yes.
Like that goes. The other thing is that in the social sciences and in just science in general, we like to be able to predict things and to model things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by definition, you can't model or predict chance. It's random. So what social scientists have done is said, well, that's just noise. That's
and
we're just going to throw that out. Well, that's a big part of life. That's like that, you know, you're throwing out a big component here. And so that's my point, is that, you know, this is important. And you really see the role of chance when you start talking to people, talking about their lives and thinking about it that way. That's where it really kind of comes out.
Yeah. The fact that you sort of, I often think of economics as doing things like what you were just describing, is the messy things is just noise, and we're going to focus on our assumptions,
right?
You know, as if life worked that way. But I hadn't thought about it so much. And it seems to me, what do you think? I mean, if you were a young person starting out your career, and you came to this notion, this calling to pursue this, instead of poverty, right? That young Mark Rank says, God, this whole luck chance, what would you even do? How can, I mean, you had to have thought about this and had conversation about this, but it's like we've decided, you and I have agreed that it's not good to pretend it isn't important. It's not good to pretend that it doesn't play a crucial role, but what do you do with that?
Yeah. So I think And again, that's one of the reasons why this hasn't been studied so much. But there are, you know, there are ways, and I point out several studies in the book in which people have begun to start thinking about modeling this and thinking about this, you know, in kind of different ways. So, you know, I think this is this is like a really burgeoning, could be a really burgeoning field that's out there. You know, and one of the, for the young person, you know, I would say, look, one of the opportunities is there's not a lot of people studying this.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can really make a name. You know, for me, this is like kind of, you know, well, my career is kind of, you know, a lot of it's over. But for somebody coming up, you know, it could be a really, really cool opportunity.
So,
The other thing that I talk about, and this is kind of related to this, is, you know, at the end of the book, I sort of say, well, what can we learn from this? What kind of lessons do we, you know, by living in a random world, what can we learn from this? And so what I try to do is to sort of say to people, you know, here's some of the things that you can take away from this, and that actually may be positive in terms of your life. So I think that's important too.
And let's go back to the structural. You've got about 3 minutes here. The disconnect between, going back to what some of the stuff we said about poverty, disconnect between rugged individualism and it's your job to make your life work and anybody can make it who works hard, that also ignores chance and luck. How do we begin to bring this into our policy? Because our policy ignores it completely, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things I talk about is, you know, some of our policies should be focused on is the idea of thinking about it from a point of view of insurance.
Yes.
That, you know, we don't buy car insurance or home insurance because we think we're going to have an accident tomorrow. We buy it because we think, okay, some bad break or bad chance may happen to us down the road. Same thing with social policy. As we were talking about, poverty can strike people, you know, the majority of people at some point. So let's think about our policy from an insurance point of view, from a strong social safety net point of view. And it's a different way of thinking about it. And I think it's a really valuable way of thinking about it. The other thing is that the recognition of chance and randomness and luck really splashes some cold water on the idea that America is a meritocracy, that people get what they deserve. People don't always get what they deserve. Sometimes people get what they don't deserve, and other people, you know, don't get what they deserve.
Right.
So it's like that's an important lesson to keep in mind. You know, there but for the grace of God go I.
Yeah, and Michael Sandel has a wonderful book on meritocracy, which goes into this in depth. This has been a great conversation, Mark. Again, the latest book is The Random Factor, but the other books, the Poverty Paradox, Poorly Understood, Chasing the American Dream, all have a lot to say about what we've been talking about. The websites are, and here comes that long, unwieldy website again, brownschool1word.wustl, Washington University, St. Louis, wustl.edu/faculty-and-research/mark/rank. And the other thing, of course, is just to go on your browser and putting Mark Robert Rank or Mark Rank. Either one of them will get you there. And then the website, confrontingpoverty.org. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and links to probably 10 or 15 articles, timely, relevant, fleshing out the conversation, email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, @mac.com. And you can find years of podcasts at my site or at most of those major podcast sites. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence, at McNally Terrence, one word. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, Mark Rank, thank you and keep up your good work.
Oh, thanks, Terrence. It's been a delight. And let me just say to be sure to thank your lucky stars.
Absolutely. Okay, good luck with the rest of your day, the rest of your life, and so on and so on. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Okay, thanks.